You are listening to The Dystopian Republic, and I, Raul Guerrero, am your host. We begin today's story on the morning of October 19th, 1981. Vance Sr. and Sophia walked Vance Jr. out of their Clemente home and into a bus, watching it leave for school with him and 23 others inside. After kissing goodbye, sometime later, husband went east toward Bromelia City while wife traveled west to the quiet little city of Clyde Lake. Liking how the municipality circled around a lake, Sophia parked in front of a single-floor gated home with the space to be a mansion. She buzzed the doorbell, identified herself to the guards ready to shoot or unleash their pit bulls, being let in and welcomed by name as she walked up the path and had the front door opened for her. Entering the home, Sophia was amazed at how much it had grown, seeming like it was just yesterday that it was a scatter of shacks with all the land in the world. She purchased the property from its fifth owner in 1973, seeing many children and adolescents come and go. The home was known as the cradle of the humble man, tasking itself with raising kids to not be braggarts who take what they have for granted. Sophia's belief in that mission never wavered, as she too was an orphan who'd been housed there under the third owner's care. In her 8 years of running the cradle, she's never thrown any kid or teen out, believing that doing so would be an admission of failure. The amount of disrespect and even abuse Sophia took from her less obedient children won her their respect or admiration. Almost all of the kids and teens that left her home had nothing but good things to say about her, or at least they didn't have anything credible to accuse her of. In the midst of all the children who walked into her cradle and out of it, there were two who waited 5 years for a sign-off that never came: Chance and Nicole. Sophia couldn't figure out why no one wanted them, because they were well-behaved, intelligent, genteel, and had parents who died serving their country in the Ottoloon Islands War. She felt so sorry for Chance and Nicole that she told them that if she could, she'd adopt them, but chose to let them stay past their 18th birthdays. It was legal for Sophia to do that because of the social service reforms Grimsby Sr. signed into law that allowed war orphans to remain in the foster care system until age 21. Chance loved learning about the anatomy and behaviors of animals, reserving a special place in his heart for reptiles such as snakes. Nicole shared his love to learn, but it was insects such as wasps that most fascinated her. But that said, they were equally interested in dedicating their lives to the study and practice of zoology. Another thing that fascinated her and Chance was the hybridization of animals, plants, and substances, an interest Sophia incessantly encouraged and supported. Nicole's room was a library and museum for all things entomology, while Chance turned his into a shrine that sculpted, shelved, and smelled of herpetology. Sophia thought Gregorio Jr. would find the cousins' interests useful, but her superior couldn't see the potential she saw in them. Respecting that rejection, she moved on to helping Nicole and Chance earn their basic education degrees and enroll in Bromelia State University at Bromelia City. The cousins majored in zoology and were in their sophomore year when Gregorio took over, joining the thousands of students who were given the choice to serve or die. Many refused to side with the Yellow Cross, but Chance and Nicole joined the few who did. Their opportunity to serve the man who rejected them years ago. Sophia made sure the cousins were enrolled into Gregorio Lobo University, a campus built from the ashes of Habsburgo Brumel College. Now that Chance and Nicole were all in on their zoology majors and college as a whole, she was able to spend more time with Vance Jr. Sophia was adamant about the cousins being upstanding Yellow Crossers, but did not want them to be involved in the brutality of the Civil War. She thought such havoc was beneath two minds that were better off in a laboratory than out on the battlefield. Sophia was aware of the seductive lures of being a war hero and making Gregorio proud, understanding that when Vance Jr. grows up, he too will face those same temptations. She wasn't worried about her son giving in because, in her eyes, he was perfectly able and quick on his feet, but felt that the cousins flourished at a slower pace. 1986 and 1987 saw Chance and Nicole learn and mingle without interruption, earning spots on the honor roll and distinctions for being the most liked. The university had a code that strictly dressed males in suits and ties and females in blouses and skirts under penalty of expulsion. But in the mentioned years, Chance and Nicole hadn't heard anything from Sophia, and as 1988 neared, their desire to fight in the Civil War was intense and constant. They and their peers seldomly went a month without hearing about the Yellow Cross's losses, but at the same time, they didn't have to wait that long to hear about their repossessions and gains. In effect, Chance and Nicole saw the regime be at a place where they lost as much as they won and vice versa, boiling their desire over and far from the pot. On January 2nd, 1988, Gregorio held a military parade that culminated in his call for all Bromelians to join him in the fight to free Bromelia of its liberal, Marxist, and democratic cancers. He didn't give a darn if one was a housekeeper or member of his inner circle. His call for unchained war applied to everyone, including his youngest supporters. Neither Roy Sr., Roy Jr., nor anyone not associated with the Yellow Cross would receive news of this in time to prepare for that psychotic scream's walk out of talk and into action. Shattered by Gregorio's call, Sophia wrote letters begging him, Allred Sr. and Etchelstone, not to feed Chance or Nicole to the wolves, getting sympathetic yet undeterred responses. But unbeknown to her, the cousins had already been involved in the Civil War for some time now because of the very education she pushed them to pursue. The day of February 21st, 1986 was no less a sleep than most of those before it for the people of Walpolado. But for Gavrila, Cuneja, and Delfina, that cloudless morning was their chance to be in a breezy light as pretty as the Garden of Eden in forest form. They got bloated on black tea to keep themselves awake while everyone else was sleeping heavier than brick mansions. The sneak out was Gavrila's idea as she couldn't stand being active in the dark, equating it to an elephant forced to adhere to a raccoon's schedule. Cuneja accepted having to play all night and close her eyes to the daylight, but her itch to frolic in the sun worsened until her sister scratched it raw. Delfina detested the brightness that peaked every noon, but her adoration for the dimness of midnight made her feel like one of its guardian angels. She nevertheless went along with Gavrila's idea out of sisterly love and for the sake of protecting Cuneja, whom she thought was as easy to break as a twig. The girls repeatedly glanced back at Walpolado while frolicking away like it was a prison they're trying to escape from, fearing that someone would catch and go after them. Their frolic didn't lose its unease until they were 5 miles from the town, falling at how untidy, smelly, and deathly the forest turned out to be. Gavrila slowly shook her head and teared up, seeing the flesh-stained skeletons hanging like wind chimes. Horseflies flew all around Cuneja as if they were calling her an idiot for believing her sister's BS, telling her to relish the sights and sense of death everywhere while she could. Delfina shivered like she knew that leaving Walpolado would be a bad idea, wanting to scream at Gavrila for tricking herself and her own flesh and blood. Cuneja grabbed her forehead and hair and panted with an anger that wanted to savagely beat someone. Her want also being Gavrila's and Cuneja's, the sisters desired to make the offers who fooled them pay like no one ever had before. What they didn't realize was that their frolic went west when it should have been eastbound, but that wound up not mattering when they found themselves encircled by a squad of Yellow Cross soldiers. Told to keep their hands up and not move, the sisters tearfully complied, feeling that the least they could do is keep Walpolado hidden. Gavrila found gladness in knowing that her days of being a nocturnal were over, thanking heavens that the Bernardos and all of their fellow residents weren't from the town they declared as theirs. Cuneja hoped that the soldiers had conversion planned for her and her sisters, preferring that over enslavement and liquidation. Delfina was intent on resisting her capturers to the bitter effing end, having talked at length to a family that witnessed the initial murderers separate Hiram and Mercia from Chloe and Devin. She also spoke with an old man who hid in and escaped from Colchester, using his bird's eye view of Camp Sunshine to film the kids from Cabin E18 kill 4 of Duilio's guards and be subdued for the last time. Gavrila could tell from the soldiers' stares that they saw nothing purposeful or useful in her or her sisters, but weren't willing to dispose of them either. She sensed that her life and those of Cuneja and Delfina were about to undergo some excruciating modifications. For chance, Nicole and their fellow zoology majors, February 24th, walked them a mile out of campus and into a newly built facility disguised as a storm cellar. Upon entry, they were welcomed to a museum or collection of what was thought impossible, scaring them with nature at her ugliest, most aggressive, and highest level of lethality. The students were split into pairs and assigned to experienced duos, pairing Chance and Nicole with Marshall and Kelly. The male of the elder pair instructed assistants to bring in their volunteer, whom he named Subject 2, Cuneja. Her teary begging not to be hurt unnerved Nicole and slipped out her pity, but made Chance want to throw up. Kelly injected Cuneja with a barbiturate that slowed her breathing to a crawl and dulled her sadness grayer than fog at dusk. She had her slammed on a surgical table and strapped onto it as Marshall masked, shielded, and gloved up. Nicole didn't like where this was going and wanted to yell stop, but Chance was as excited as a boy in a candy shop as Kelly gazed at Cuneja as if she was a frog ready for dissection. Gavrila looked up at the circle lights with a resignation that was prepared to die, hoping that her exit from this world won't be too painful. Delfina was beaten badly as a result of her attempts to resist and escape, being secured by tourniquet tight straps. Cuneja yelled that she and her sisters had entire lives ahead of them, imploring Chance, Nicole, Kelly, and Marshall not to experiment on them or any of the other kids. Gavrila and Delfina thought she was wasting her breath, but when the four looking over her erupted in laughter, they froze as if paralysis had set in. Marshall asked Cuneja what made her think she was going to be experimented on, calling himself his wife and their apprentices above such sadism. He swore to God that the university didn't have anything malevolent or lascivious planned for her, Delfina, Gavrila, or their fellow patients. Kelly added that her husband and his physicians want to resurrect a project that was presumed dead after the misfortune at Sierra. As much as she respected Vance Sr. for dedicating his life to law and order, she admitted that he didn't have the scientific mastery to carry out Operation Machine, but said she, Marshall, and their fellow zoologists did. Kelly told Cuneja to hold still as she injected her with a paralytic too diluted to induce paralysis, making her body feel too heavy to move. Delfina felt like her mind had opened every one of its closed doors, as well as an overwhelming want for the pairs looking over her to not hold back in giving it all to her. The paralytic overrode the barbiturate from earlier at a stroke, releasing the sisters from one state and restraining them with another. It vibrated Gavrila's nerves such that she felt like she was sitting in a massage chair, and the feeling was fantastic and intoxicating. Heavy and unsedated, with their minds wide open and ready to be fed, the sisters paid no heed to what was about to be done to them. Marshall, Kelly, Nicole, Chance, and their equivalents exited the operating rooms and pressed buttons that opened the floors and locked its doors. 10-foot-deep metal pits full of cobra, rattlesnake, viper mixes with maroon skin and emerald eyes were revealed. Marshall told the students to say hello to his biting fortifiers as his creations slithered up the operating table and were all over the sisters and their fellow subdued. His vipers spat on his subjects the way mosquitoes would prior to feeding, but they wouldn't stop until they saw their targets soaked in their saliva. Marshall said that common wisdom dictated that the coming bites would leave consequences of a lethal and likely deadly nature. He added that this did not apply to the biting fortifiers, as he bred and had others engineer the lethality out of the venom, but replaced it with something even better. His vipers had a ball injecting all of their poison into Marshall's subjects, stopping when he showered the operating rooms with a dermally absorbent and highly fragrant anesthetic. The sisters and the others who were bitten went to sleep, and the biting fortifiers slithered back to the pits amassed in that cramped space and slumbered. Marshall dismissed the students for lunch and ordered them to report back to his facility in 4 days' time to see his subjects in their completed states. Once alone with Kelly again, he had her savor the slumbers before them as the beginning of their ascensions into sainthood. Veal, scallopini, rutkull, gazpacho soup, melon soda, and gerbode cake comprised a meal meant to give the students a lesson in cultural identity. Chance listened intently and took notes at the speed of a court transcriber, but Nicole struggled to take in the knowledge and was barely able to paraphrase what was said. He wasn't worried about the project he was introduced to going wrong because of how smoothly and easily it was able to be started. Nicole didn't care about whether Marshall's subjects would die or be disabled, but what did make her worry was how much he loved himself. She could tell that even Kelly had her concerns, but asked herself what good speaking out would do, refusing to blame her or herself for staying silent. Nicole told herself that Marshall's competence better match his confidence, for if it doesn't, then things could get dire in a hurry. Her worry over his self-love was less than what he may've accidentally created, a plague even the most skilled doctors would be unable to contain. Nicole noticed that the biting fortifiers had rather nasally hisses and watery fluid leaking out of their nostrils. Her fear was that Marshall's vipers contained a virus unlike anything known to science, and his subjects would carry it and be forced to spread it to the enemy. Nicole figured out what his operation machine was all about wiping out Roy Sr.'s side and those of other foes with a super pathogen. The only thing she still didn't get was how Marshall would get his subjects across enemy lines in time to infect others, for she knew that anyone infected had days to live. When Gavrila, Corneja, Delfina, and their fellow subdued woke up 3 hours later, the snake bites all over them spun them into a hysteria that even the most powerful drugs couldn't mellow out. Marshall locked his subjects up in prison cells the size of closets, cramming sinks, toilets, and beds such that pacing around was not possible. It wasn't until late that night when the hysteria dulled enough for him and his wife to feel comfortable leaving them unattended. Most of the university's students, faculty, and workers slept well, but Nicole, Kelly, and a few others did not, fearing the plague that Marshall was cooking up. Over that night, into the next day, and one after, the bit-up subjects sweated through their clothes, had painful fevers, ceaseless chills, and mucus sprinting out of their noses. Nicole gave the sunrise a scowl as intense as her anger toward Marshall for exposing her, Chance, and her peers to his super virus. Keeping that rage inside, she expected to wake up the following day with a sore throat, but when that symptom didn't come, it was as if a weight had come off her back. And come February 28th, Nicole was as excited as Chance was to see Marshall's finished products, expecting a collection of bipedal weapons. The symptoms that the sisters and their fellow subdued were suffering from had subsided, leaving them with a drowsiness that was all but gone. The students were piled into a theater that was really a lounge-like media room that surveilled the prison cells. Nicole wasn't fooled by how better the subjects got, assumed that they were as contagious as they were days ago, and was ready to scorn Marshall for endangering her and her peers. Even Chance didn't like how docile the sisters and their fellow subdued were, recalling that being a common symptom of rabies. When Marshall pointed at him after he raised his hand, he asked if any zoonotic diseases were used in the implementation of Operation Machine, causing a flurry of gasps. Chance was assured that the subjects weren't rabid, told to relax and let the assistants prove that there was nothing for him to worry about. Delfina sat on her bed, looked down, and was submerged in her thoughts while Gavrila gave the camera in her cell a shy yet adorable grin. Corneja stared at the ceiling, moving her mouth like she was talking to herself, twitching her fists and becoming more agitated. Nicole felt ill watching Marshall's assistants enter the cell block without protection, with keys in hand and not a threat in sight. Gavrila's grin turned to her cell door being opened, beholding a man who told her to stand up, turn away from him, and walk back. She, her sisters, and their fellow subdued complied as their snake bites itched and painfully tingled. The itches and tingles were the result of an adrenaline being freed of its shackles and the brain's new and improved form hatching out of its egg. When both subsided. The forced docility was the only thing that Marshall's subjects were feeling. Disturbing chance, so. Nicole didn't see any security and wanted to just run the hell out of the cellar, but stayed seated in fear of being disciplined for being weak. She saw Marshall's subjects tense up, and that slipped out a shriek so repressed that it sounded like a hiccup. Three of her peers caught this as well and got themselves ready to stand up and run for the door as Chance had his eyes on the fire alarm, preparing to arm and pull it down. What the sisters and their fellow subdued were experiencing was a lust so stimulating that it left them with only the choice of blowing it out like a downburst. An assistant grabbed and crossed Delfina's wrists. She broke out of his grip, kicked him in the groin, and threw him at the two he had in tow, knocking them all on their backs. She heard six gunshots, leapt and rolled out of her cell and looked left and up at Gavrila shooting the subordinates assigned to escort her out. Delfina then caught Coneja slicing up the throats of the three assistants tasked with transferring her, joining her sisters and fellow subdued in their shooting, stabbing, and beating party. Marshall screamed for reinforcements to quell the massacre, ordering the students to stay where they were and not panic. Nicole watched as the assistants were having their groins stabbed in, larynxes ripped out, skin carved up like beef chucks, hair yanked off, bones broken into halves or more, and blood splashed and smeared everywhere. Kelly wanted to tell Marshall that she knew he'd lose control of his project, but was only able to ask him what he was going to do now. Her husband obtained his answer when his subjects escaped the cell row, scaring Chance into jumping from his seat to arm and pull down the fire alarm, which didn't work, to his severe dismay. Marshall put the whole cellar on lockdown and told everyone to hide and be prepared to use deadly force should their hiding places be breached. He then had the cellar's secret back entrance opened so that his subjects could get out and be allowed to freely roam. The sisters and their fellow ex-subdued escaped as a pack went north and kept darting until the adrenaline wore off half a mile after the second. A long time went by before Marshall had the confidence to end the lockdown, thanking heavens that it was over. The students couldn't figure out what was more egregious, the failure they witnessed, or what was just let out into society. Marshall had nothing defensive to say, knowing that he and Kelly would be punished if word of their screw-up got out. He advised the students against telling anyone about what had just transpired, reminded them of how high up he and his wife were in Gregorio's society, and dared them to defy his authority. Marshall called himself the leader and them the followers, threatening to have them die infinite deaths if so much as a word about this mistake was said. He begged the students to look at this as an unforeseeable mistake and repeated this until it was imprinted onto their minds. Some students made themselves believe what Marshall said, while others, like Chance and Nicole, didn't, but chose not to speak out for the sake of their ambitions. One question that remained was how the ex-subjects could kill so efficiently and mutilate with such assiduousness, despite the fact that they were all teenagers. The students were escorted out of the cellar and were shocked to find that they left right on schedule and that their peers acted like nothing went awry. Marshall was positive that no one will find out about his screw-up, but Kelly reminded him that he still had an operation to do. He told her that Operation Machine was still on and that he had a second cohort en route from a settlement that was squashed a couple weeks ago. Marshall thought that setting people up to spread disease was stupid, but now it was his only way out, and one where help from the outside was required. He had his surviving assistants clean up the mess left in the cell row, giving them a day to make it sterile and ready for the coming payload. 31 miles northeast of Lobotown, April 15th, rose the sun to Jacob, stepping out of his summertime cabin in clothes as worn as tires with no tread. He was alone, wanting to get out of Bromelia, starving for company and wondering what his colleagues and loved ones back in Bromelby were up to since he went into hiding. Jacob wasn't loyal to Gregorio or Roy, but was afraid that being Bromelian American would make him a target for both sides. He found his location to be an escape from the 7-day-a-week grind of getting Jack Drade health out of operating at a loss. Jacob didn't find out about Gregorio's takeover until a month after, when he noticed that no one had been in the area since the day before the 1984 election. Since then, he survived on what he took with him, the source of clean water he found a mile away, containing fish and having edible berries surrounding it. Jacob had one of the chests Habsburgo Sr. buried, stumbling upon it after it was unearthed by a week of rain. He was aware of what was in his possession, and while his isolation prevented him from making any use of it, he remained determined to get back to Bromelby. Jacob ran into his cabin and out with his bag of bait and fishing rods, and was about to fish for his lunch when he heard multiple people roaming nearby. He dropped what he held, removed his shoes, got down, crawled into a dirt pit under his shelter, and hid there as the noise neared. Jacob lied on his belly and looked ahead as the roaming got closer, telling himself that this may be the end of him. He had never seen any Yellow Cross patrols or loyalists on the hunt, but feared that sooner or later someone from the regime would find him. The noise stopped after it repeatedly drew near and walked further away for half an hour. Jacob thought he was in the clear, but waited another 20 minutes to be sure, crawling out and standing up, glad that was over. He chuckled at how close that was and went for his bait and fishing rods, but inches shy of touching either, he jolted back and almost fell. After causing the things he saw to react similarly, Jacob realized that it was just Gavrila, Coneja, and Delfina wearing the clothes they escaped with. The dried blood, snake bites, and filth all over the sisters made him want to cry, and their hearts ached at how beat up by the elements he looked. Interrupted by children mewling, Jacob, Gavrila, Cuneja, and Delfina ran to them and found Six, Purdy, Hutton, Vivian, Mead, Bryn, and Emilio. The want to kill that drove the sisters to slaughter Marshall's assistants was as dormant as a virus waiting for the right opportunity to attack its host. Jacob asked the Six where their parents were and was told this: shoot, gone, friends, take away, town, burn, nothing left. On March 2nd, Roy logged onto his control center, called one of his squads situated near Lobotown, and was aghast to hear no answer. He nervously called the other four, and his heart raced when his attempts to connect with them also went unanswered. As elite as can be, the five squads were part of a mission to assassinate Gregorio and his inner circle. Roy thought that wiping out the leadership will leave the regime leaderless, remembering how Alexis Jr. and his cabinet's vamooses led to the downfall of their rule. This was the plan Sinclair drew out for him to implement, and as underhanded as it appeared, both had a promise to keep: win the Civil War at the earliest possible opportunity. Roy attempted to contact each of the squads again, and when those went unanswered, he was convinced that the regime had got them. While said units had been wiped out, the people responsible weren't Yellow Jackets, but were really eight of Marshall's ex-subjects. Sinclair calmed away Roy's impulse to break down in tears and assured him that all was not lost, telling him to look at the squads' demises as a setback. He said this war will be long and full of suffering, but quitting now would render that hurting purposeless. All the more reason to continue their fight to free Bromelia of the fascist chains bounding it. On the morning of March 3rd, Marshall got a call from Etchelstone and was asked how Operation Machine was moving along. He answered that as of them speaking, his subjects were working their infecting magic, calling the project successful enough to warrant additional cohorts. Etchelstone applauded Marshall for his excellent work, thanked him for cleaning up Vance Sr.'s mess, and said that he'll be rewarded. Gregorio hadn't found out about Roy's plan or the disaster at his university preparing for his trip to Sajonlement. He was to meet with Fleming and discuss a non-aggression pact between Bromelia and Sojitalia, hoping to convince the West that he was a man of peace. All over Lobotown were troops with machine guns the size of rocket launchers, wearing armor that stretched like spandex while being as tough as Red Waxton. Gregorio looked out at the sunrise and had an assistant light his cigar, smoking it while watching his guards patrol his castle. Izzasso approached him from his left, told him that this heaven was what she yearned to make a reality all her life, and he sternly responded that he knew. Gregorio said his climb to the top, step on the summit, and time spent there came about as he predicted, grinning at the bright future shining outside. He saw himself at the helm of a world order where the West and East unite to serve him and recognize the Yellow Cross as the breeder of order, extinguisher of degeneracy, and demonstrator of solidarity. Working as normal didn't help Marshall get over the fact that he lied to Etchelstone, and the thought of what he unleashed only added to his anxiety. He considered getting rid of his biting fortifiers, but chose to fix them the way only a zoologist of his type knew how. Marshall opted not to have any more students visit his cellar for the foreseeable future, and preferred to present his successes via lecture or assembly. Some within the university senate deemed that a departure from a man who wore openness on his sleeves, prompting the initiation of a secret investigation into his handling of Operation Machine. In the weeks after February 28th, Marshall worked on his Vipers as more cohorts were delivered to him, stuffing his cells like cluttered closets. He also spent that time having Kelly draw out and organize the deliveries of his new subjects to areas past enemy lines. She balanced getting the logistics of the transports right and failing multiple times with taking care of Keller and her other children. That contaminated her marriage with Keller such that the two opted not to sleep together until their respective assignments were done. Nicole, Chance, and their fellow zoology majors had their dorm rooms secured with triple locks and window guards to the confusion of everyone else. Even though the university respected these additions, they and most students thought they were unnecessary because they were in Lobotown for crying out loud. There was a common belief that the town was immune from enemy influence and made impenetrable by its indigoed municipal guard. Early on April 16th, he swabbed the mouth of one of his recompleted biting fortifiers, placed it into a tube of saline, and was introduced to his super virus, Venofa virus. And at the strike of midnight on the 17th, Marshall had his new subjects readied for the trucks that were to transport and drop them off, applauding himself for a job well done. He was also proud of the disinfection sterilization procedure that encompassed the whole cellar experience from entry to exit and repeat. The more the zoology majors used their locks and window guards, the more certain the other students were that they were hiding something. And as fate would have it, every side involved or uninvolved in the Civil War would soon suffer the real consequences of Marshall's mistake. And that was the Angels and Subjects. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to listen to the story I just gave. Share this show with everyone you know. Make sure they share it with everyone they know. Check out my website at www.rss.com/podcasts/The Dystopian Republic. Send me your respectful questions and constructive feedback at RaulGuerreroJr95@gmail.com. On that note, I'm Raul Guerrero, and come again for another gripping, thoughtful, and sinister episode of The Dystopian Republic.